Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, we play an interview host Craig LeBeau recorded with Joe O'Connor, a researcher for the book Justice on Fire, about the 1988 explosion at a construction site that killed six KCMO firefighters. He also produced a documentary film about the incident. Then, we replay an important interview from last year when host Latar Smith spoke with attorney Taylor Rickard of the Kent E. Gibson Law Firm about how prosecutorial overcharging leads to longer prison sentences, wrongful convictions, and more. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Craig and his guest.
This is Craig LeBeau, and thank you for joining us here on Jaws of Justice. I have Joe O'Connor with me. Joe is a researcher who assisted his father in producing a book called Justice on Fire, and then he has also produced a documentary. And this is about the firefighter case from back in
November 29th, 1988 is when it occurred.
And this is where some firefighters were killed as a result of an explosion, and some people were charged. Tell us about the background of that, please, Joe.
Well, what happened was there was a routine truck fire on the side of a highway kind of call to the fire department. I think it was around 3:40 a.m. And so one fire truck came, and they started putting out that fire when they noticed another fire across the street at a construction site. At the time, they were expanding Highway 71 to connect it to the Grandview Triangle 435 in South Kansas City. So they were excavating rock out of that area. So it's a major construction site. And they noticed this fire up on this hill, and they called another pumper up there. Once the fire in the pickup truck was extinguished, both fire trucks went up on the hill to fight what would become their last fire.
The explosion that occurred, what was the cause of that as far as you were able to determine?
Well, it was kind of a series of events that happened. There was two tractor trailers, semi-trailers, parked close together, and they weren't placarded with what was inside. So actually, since this event happened, they changed the regulations on this, where all trailers with hazardous materials have to be placarded, even if they're sitting there and not in transit. So when these firefighters arrived at the scene, they saw this trailer on fire, and it didn't have any warning that what was inside it. And they also saw there was two federal lock boxes nearby, which contained dynamite to blast the rock, and they saw that those were like a far distance away, and so they proceeded to try to fight this fire on this trailer. One of the firefighters radioed into dispatch that it appears like there's magnesium burning inside this trailer, which if you apply water to it, it makes a bigger flame. So it was like a chemical fire, but they couldn't identify what was actually inside it. And what was inside it was ammonium nitrite and fuel oil, also known as ANFO. And it detonated, instantly killing the six firefighters.
So was it the hazardous chemicals is what exploded then and not the dynamite?
No, the dynamite was at a safe distance away. And federal safety regulators analyzed this incident, and they determined that was probably one of the factors that downgraded the severity of the situation for the firefighters responding to this fire. They could see that the dynamite was clearly a safe distance away, and they thought what what was initially reported as explosives in the area were in those yellow boxes, but that wasn't the case. There was these trailers filled with 25,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate in one, and I think 15,000 pounds in the other. So these were seriously stacked blasting agents used to break up the rock at the site.
As a result of this, there were several people charged. How did they come to determine that they believed that it was arson and not just an accident as a result of the hazardous chemicals?
Well, there were two fires at the scene. One was in the pickup truck, which was on the other side of the highway at the time, the west side of the site, and there was an arson fire on the east side where the trailers were. And a well-respected arson investigator for a private company analyzed the site, and he said that the fire was set around the tires and the back axle of one of these trailers, probably using like cardboard and straw. They had straw bales, whatever they could burn around there. Somebody put gasoline on that and lit that on fire. So it was clearly a case of arson.
There's no dispute that it was arson, so the question is whether or not they were in fact the guilty parties or whether there were other people involved that were not prosecuted.
Well, initially, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, they followed hundreds of leads. There was a tip hotline, and people were calling in saying, so-and-so did this, so-and-so did that. And they've tracked down all these leads. And initially, some of these defendants came up in these tips. And they went out, and they thoroughly investigated their stories and determined that they had no involvement in this crime. 8 years later, the ATF, investigating this case, their leads into organized crime dried up, and they didn't know what to pursue next, so they started to go over these old leads from the Marlboro neighborhood nearby the construction site. They found that there's people spreading rumors. I think there was about a $3,000 reward initially, and that got bumped up to $50,000. The ATF got together with the TV show Unsolved Mysteries, and they did a recreation of the crime. And after that, tips started pouring in left and right about people in the Marlboro area. And so the ATF went around and basically collected these tips and focused in on five people from that area. And they were... by all accounts, petty criminals, people that couldn't mount a defense against kind of the federal government coming after them, accusing them of this crime. Even though there was no physical evidence and there was no eyewitness tying any of these people to this crime, a number of tips came in, and they used, I believe, over 50 informants, most of them convicted felons, against these five people to say that they bragged somehow that they did this crime.
These five people, were they zeroed in partly because of criminal records, or were these people who had clean criminal records before this?
Some of them were actually in police custody at the time the indictments came down. But one, Richard Brown, he had some speeding tickets, driving with a suspended license, but he didn't actually have a criminal record. The other ones did, but they were for, like, petty little crimes. I interviewed one of the police officers, a homicide detective, Victor Zinn, and he said it straight up to me that these people would probably be in custody more or less throughout their lives, but that still doesn't mean that they committed this crime. So it was kind of easy people to pin this on.
One of them later, I believe, has been released. Is that correct, Brian Shepard?
Yeah. There was a Supreme Court case called Miller versus Alabama where a juvenile was given a resentence hearing because it was deemed unconstitutional, cruel punishment to sentence a juvenile to life without possibility of parole. So that's what Brian Shepard, he was 17 at the time of the crime. He was granted a resentencing hearing, and his lawyer successfully argued that he spent 22 years in prison for this crime, and so he's already done his time. You know, that was the constitutional sentence that he should have received, and he already served it. So he was released.
All five of these, they're still trying to establish their innocence. Is that correct?
Well, one, Skip Shepherd, he died in prison, I believe, in 2009. But there's three still in there, and they, yes, they're still fighting and saying they're innocent. Nobody of the defendants has ever claimed responsibility for this crime.
So as far as the evidence that would tend to establish that they were in fact innocent, what have you come across to establish that?
Well, there's a lot out there. For one, I've researched pretty much every document I could get my hands on. I'm not going to just say that they're innocent without having evidence to back it up. But throughout the years, there have been reports that have been not given over to the defense. There's been crime scene photographs that were not turned over to the defense. Basically, the prosecution went to trial with the defense attorneys with, you know, one hand tied behind their back in terms of defending these five people. So initially, what was really startling was there was this Gloria Nolan report that I believe somebody from the Midwest Innocence Project found, where it was this passerby, this woman who worked at a hospital. She was bringing her child to the emergency room that night, and she spotted two vehicles circling the area with their spotlights out of their sunroofs, like they were security guards. She saw them circling the area while this pickup truck was on fire. So the security guards, their initial alibi was that they were up at Quick Trip at the time when the pickup truck was set on fire. So her testimony, or excuse me, her police report directly contradicts their alibi that night. That was a big indication that, you know, oh, well, there's something here that they're hiding from us. And I think it was about 2015 or so, I went down to the Kansas City Police Headquarters, and they were willing to let me get copies of their crime scene photographs. Once I did that, I didn't really know what I was looking at until I met with the former homicide detective Victor Zinn out at the site, and he challenged me. He said a police report about this, that one of the guards, who was a female, she left her purse and other personal items, as well as the keys into the pickup truck, in the car while it was running, and she left and went to Quick Trip to go buy coffee and dessert rolls or whatever. So he's like, explain to me how this makes any sense. And so looking over these police photographs, I saw a picture at the crime scene, at the scene, of these items sitting there on the seat of her pickup truck. I'm not a fire expert by any means, but I could tell clearly, like, there was a plastic grocery bag, a yellow sweatshirt, there was a white vinyl ladies' billfold, her billfold, and what appeared to be like a paper booklet, which I assume might be like a road atlas type thing. And each of these items is sitting there on the seat with varying degrees of fire damage. Now, according to the fire dispatch tape from the fire department, this fire lasted at least 17 minutes before that first fire truck arrived and put this fire out. And by all accounts, this was a blazing fire. I mean, there was flames shooting out of this pickup truck, so much that the steel roof of the truck warped from the heat. So how can you explain these items sitting there on the seat in various degrees of damage when they should have all been consumed? I sent these photographs off to the former Olathe fire marshal, who is one of the top-notch fire experts in the area, and he analyzed the photos, and he said it would be impossible for these items to be in that pickup truck in the condition seen in the photograph. He had a few theories why this could be. Maybe the firefighters put these items in after the fire just to clean things up, or that they were added after the fire for some unknown reason. So if they were added afterwards, then they wouldn't have fire damage on them. So it's kind of like it's either it is or it isn't. And so I sent this information off to the chief of the Kansas City Fire Department and the chief of the Kansas City Police, and they both agreed to forward this information to the U.S. Attorney's Office, who has so far not acted on this. What I found out through all this process is that the items that are seen in this photograph were collected by the Kansas City Police, and they still have that in their evidence room. So these items still exist, and they're just sitting on a shelf in bags. They could easily be retested, find out if there was a second fire event that happened that night or not. Because if there was, then we'll know exactly what happened or not. But if you think about this for a second, the whole motive for the crime at the trial was that there was these teenagers, these people on drugs or whatever, they went to vandalize and steal stuff. Well, the items from the pickup truck, there was a purse with $6.51 in it. There was reportedly like a firearm on the seat of the truck. That wasn't supposedly taken. And there was, you know, a radio still in the truck. There was all these items of value. So why wouldn't those be taken? And if you think about it, they're the items of the security guard. They're her personal items. So how would these people get a hold of these items? And why would they go back to the crime scene and try to light these on fire after the explosion already happened? It just doesn't make any sense at all. For the five people that were convicted.
So if there was a second fire event that evening, is it possible that that would have been the result of hot spots that were not actually put out completely when the fire department initially left?
No. So this is all within the pickup truck. And that's another important point, is that the firefighters, they drenched it with their fire hose and completely put this truck fire out before they went across the street. One thing that the fire investigator expert that I hired to analyze these photos noted was that these items also weren't wet from firefighting efforts. So had they been in the pickup truck, they would be wet. So there, you have a sweatshirt, you have, you know, a plastic grocery bag, you have these items. They would be wet if they were in the pickup truck during that time.
The evidence is that those items all belong to the security guard, is that correct?
Yeah, they were her personal items that she had with her on duty that night. It was a sweatshirt. She told police that she kept her purse, the billfold, and the plastic bag. But what was most, you know, disturbing is that she didn't really say this much when she was interviewed that morning to police, and they were smart enough to put it on Betamax tape, her testimony that, you know, what she left in the truck. Police revisited her 2 days later, and she told a different story that her brother, who was another security guard at the site, went back to her pickup truck and collected a firearm that supposedly she left under the seat and removed it from a crime scene. But if you look at the other police reports, you know, there was a Sergeant Chester Rice right in the middle of that road who would have pulled them over had they seen them do what they said, go down the road 71 towards 95th Street where the police command post was set up and then go back towards the pickup truck. It just couldn't have happened. And then there was actually another witness who saw a station wagon leave the scene with the guy covering his face, and they went eastbound on 87th Street, past 435 Highway, and then took a right turn on Blue Ridge Boulevard, I believe it was. And that goes right to Grandview, Missouri, where their parents were located at the time. So Victor Zinn, responding to the call initially, realized that one of the witnesses, Deborah Riggs, one of the security guards, was now at her parents' house in Grandview, Missouri, where he immediately went out to pick her up and bring her downtown for questioning. So basically, Highway 71 divided the site in two. So the pickup truck was on what was known as the west side of the site, and then the hazardous material trailer was on the east side of the site, which is kind of up a dirt road. It's on a kind of like a bluff. It was, you know, not easy to get up there.
If the security guards were the ones that happened to have been involved in starting the arson, particularly what caused the explosion on the other side, what, do you think the truck fire would have been started as a diversion from the other side of the highway, or do you have theory on that?
Well, that story that they told at the trial, but if you think about it, if you go by the security guard's alibi that they were up at Quick Trip at 85th and Hickman Mills Road, about a half mile north of the site, there's no sense to divert guards that aren't even on the site. That makes no sense. If anything, it brought the guards back to the site, because a witness who was driving by in her Camaro made a U-turn and went back to Quick Trip and told the manager, like, there's a truck on fire right down the street. And he goes outside with her, and he's like, hey, your pickup truck's on fire right down the road. Like, you might want to go check that out. And that was the initial call to the police, that that was the initial reporting that something was on fire that night. So they're sitting in the parking lot eating rolls, drinking coffee, while this woman comes running in to Quick Trip and tells the manager that stuff's on fire right down the road.
And you said you talked to the police chief and the, I guess, fire marshal?
The fire chief. The fire expert guy was the former fire marshal of Olathe, Kansas, who analyzed the photos.
All right. Has the U.S. Attorney's Office contacted you and talked to you about the evidence you and theories you came up with?
No, they have not. I've sent them a brief explanation of some of the research that I've done, and I haven't heard back from them. But recently, the Western District of Missouri got a new U.S. attorney, so I'm going to try again and hopefully explain some of this stuff to them.
Let me have you give your website that people can look at, and also mention the Kansas City Star article that ran a few years ago.
Well, the website I've been working on is called KansasCityFirefightersCase.com, and is basically a clearinghouse of information about this case. That's what initially got me involved in this research, was a Star article. I think maybe you're referring to maybe Mike McGraw's investigation?
Well, there's an article from your site by J.J. Maloney.
Oh, okay. Well, that was published in the New Times of Kansas City. That was my father's alternative newspaper in the 1990s, I believe. And he published a two-part series about the case. He was a former Kansas City Star reporter, and he was actually a convict himself. And he assisted Darlene Edwards, one of the defendant's attorney, during the trial. So he took notes and tried to help her defense team. But while he did so, he was noticing that there was all these convicted felons lining up to get this $50,000 reward that was offered in the case. And that none of these two witnesses or informants had the same story. So there was over 50 of them, and so there's five defendants, and none of them were in the same place during all these stories. And that just struck him odd, that this would happen. But it's kind of like if you say something repeatedly enough times, then it might become true. But he also noticed that the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case acknowledged there's no physical evidence or eyewitness that actually saw these people do it. All this is just secondhand. Somebody was bragging at a party that they had something to do with it, although none of the defendants ever said that they did it.
You know,
there was talk in the neighborhood, because it woke everybody up in the whole metropolitan area. So there was talk in the neighborhood, but that's not admitting guilt. That's two different things. If I could just say one last thing.
Sure.
Well, through talking to people about this case, we went to the firefighters' families, the families of the defendants. We went to the firehouses that these men came from. The police officers themselves, the lawyers who represented these people, they all feel a deep sadness and pain about this case. It's a terrible, agonizing thing happening here in Kansas City, and it seems like it can be simply resolved if the U.S. Attorney's Office analyzes the photographs and tests the evidence that the Kansas City police still have in their possession. That will definitively show one way or another who was involved, and justice can be served.
Would DNA testing be one the type of test that they might be able to use on this?
Well, they could test for fingerprints, I believe, and also fire recreation analysis. So they could find out if this was a small fire source that created these burn patterns, or was this a raging fire like everyone claimed it to be for 17 minutes long. So it would be pretty easy to tell the difference between the two.
Okay. All right. Thank you for joining us, son.
Now, the calendar for the week of April 1st. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, April 1st, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For more information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, March 5th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. They will be discussing bills pending in the Missouri legislature, lobbying efforts, and more. Corey's Network, the Kelsey Smith Foundation, Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and Avila University invite you to attend the National Crime Victims Week Vigil, Monday, April 8th, 6 p.m. at the Jeannie Hamilton Olufsen Plaza on the Avila campus, 11901 Warnell Road, KCMO. This commemoration will include speeches and a candle lighting ceremony in the chapel. Moore Squared's Missouri Issues Action Night will meet Monday, April 1st, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Trinity Methodist Church, 620 East Armor Boulevard, KCMO. The Criminal Justice, Education, Housing, and Workforce Task Forces will all meet. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, and now to Latara and her guest.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project, and this morning I have the pleasure to interview an awesome attorney, Taylor Rickard, and she has a lot to tell us today as we speak on the subject of prosecutorial overcharging. Taylor, are you there with us?
I am here today.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Now, Taylor, as you heard me say, our subject today is going to be prosecutorial overcharging, okay? And for those listening that don't know what prosecutorial overcharging is, can you provide that definition for our listeners?
Sure. So prosecutorial overcharging is basically when a prosecutor will file charges that they can't really prove. So they'll file charges that the elements necessary to actually prove the crime, they don't have that evidence.
For those who are listening, let's just break it down a little further. Exactly what is a prosecutor and what is a prosecutor's role in our community?
Well, the prosecutor basically brings charges as part of the state. They bring charges against the criminal defendant. And so their role, they actually have pretty broad discretion in filing charges and actually dropping charges as well. So technically, their role is they're supposed to bring charges only when they have probable cause to do so. So if they think that a defendant may not be guilty, or if they have doubts in their guilt, they're technically not supposed to file charges. However, that's not always the case.
I want to make it clear for people who are listening. A prosecutor is a powerful, powerful person in our community. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And prosecutors have what's called prosecutorial immunity, which means that no matter what they do in the course of their duty as a prosecutor, they can't be sued. You can't recover civil damages against a prosecutor.
And like I said, a prosecutor is very powerful. The power prosecutors have to charge people with crimes is most times and often it's overlooked. So while probable cause is the minimum standard police officers need to make an arrest and the minimum standard to convict, the minimum standard to convict is beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed this crime. So when
Correct.
We have issues of prosecutorial overcharge, you know, what's even known as prosecutorial overreaching, that's really not fair for the prosecutors to do that, because if you have someone that's being charged with second degree murder, but actually what happened was much less than second degree murder, then it kind of appears that not only is it unfair, but it also puts that defendant in a position where they have to take a plea. Do you think that prosecutorial overcharging is used to negotiate higher pleas?
Yeah, and I certainly agree. Basically, how prosecutorial overcharging works is it happens kind of in two different ways. So the first kind of way is when a prosecutor files more charges than they should be filing. So they'll charge multiple counts of a certain offense that really that they only should be charging one count. And then the other way that it happens is that a prosecutor will charge an offense for a higher, more serious offense than what it should be charged. So we see this a lot where any cases involving, you know, murder, they'll always charge a first-degree murder charge when kind of coerce a defendant into taking a second-degree murder charge just because that would avoid them from getting life in prison, life without parole.
Right, right. And I hear about that as well as I have seen that often. I've even seen in cases where individuals were innocent and wrongly convicted, okay? And I can't say that I've seen that here in the state of Missouri, but I know in Texas, when I worked over there in Texas and volunteered quite a bit, that there were individuals who wanted to get out of prison. They were most definitely innocent, wrongly convicted, but because they couldn't just actually get their cases overturned, what they end up doing is pleading out to a lesser charge and getting time served so that they could go ahead and get out of prison, but they actually never committed the crime. So I just don't understand how that happens.
Right. So a lot of times when you take a case to trial, there is a huge uncertainty. It's a huge risk. You don't know what you're going to get. So a lot of times someone who may have been a defendant that may have been acquitted, if they were to actually exercise their right to a trial by jury, is so afraid that they're going to get such a long sentence that they'll actually plead guilty to a crime that they didn't commit or one that they absolutely shouldn't be pleading guilty to just because they're so afraid of what's going to happen if they actually take their case to trial.
You know, most people are not versed in the law. You know, when they get slapped with, I'm charged with second degree murder, their bonds are going to be higher, which mm-hmm. means they're going to be in jail, you know, because their bonds are higher, which if they were charged with the right crime that they committed, if they committed any crime at all, you know, their bonds would be lower and they could stand a chance to go ahead and bond out and get out. But if you're in there and you're on a higher charge, you know, if you've been overcharged, then that means that your bond and everything is going to be higher. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And basically what happens with that is it not only causes them to have a higher bond or anything, they'll have to serve jail time that they maybe otherwise shouldn't, but it creates a huge issue for somebody's reputation, because once those charges have been filed, the damage has already been done. Whether or not they don't actually end up getting convicted of that charge, it can be catastrophic to someone's reputation.
Of course. And I have seen that happen. I've seen people's lives ruined in reference to just what you just said. It's a thin line. Is prosecutorial overcharging prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes. I definitely think so. And unfortunately, the plea bargaining process is absolutely essential to, the criminal process, because if it weren't for that, then their criminal cases would sit in court for so long, there would be no way to move all these cases through the courts.
Exactly.
But it's just unfortunate that there's no really mechanism that this is police, just because prosecutors don't ever get in trouble, even those that systematically do this on a regular basis.
Right. I was reading up on prosecutorial overcharging, and I want to read this here because I thought this was very interesting. It says, one of the most common strategies used by prosecutors is to overcharge a defendant. There are a number of strategic reasons why prosecutors may overcharge those accused of a crime. The key reason is that the deputy district attorney or the lead prosecutor knows that they must move a large volume of cases through the court system. The way this is accomplished is via plea bargaining and negotiation. Prosecutors know that when they overcharge cases, that this is going to encourage a guilty plea in exchange for a reduction in the charge of the offense that should have been charged originally. I was knocked off my feet when I read that. What do you think about that, Taylor?
I mean, that's absolutely correct. That's the main reason that this happens, is just because there is such, prosecutors have massive caseloads, and they really have such a high incentive to get a defendant to plead guilty, just because it's easier on them and it's more efficient to have a defendant plead guilty, because it saves them time from having to hold on to the case, because plea bargaining allows cases to be, you know, disposed of quicker. They don't have to prepare for a trial and do all the work that goes into getting ready to try a case.
And I know I ask you if prosecutorial overcharging is a form of prosecutorial misconduct. But let me flip it to the defense side. Let's say the defense attorney. If a defense attorney can see that their client has been overcharged, should that defense attorney fight to address that issue and make sure their client is charged correctly?
Well, they can go ahead. Courts have the ability to dismiss charges. They just don't often do so. It's just making sure that in the jury instructions and all that, that a jury knows that they don't have to convict someone of this more serious charge, and that they know that the jury is aware that they can convict someone of a lesser offense, and they need to know that they need to prove all the elements that go into a charge beyond a reasonable doubt before they convict someone.
Because someone asked me that, you know, someone said, you know, hey, listen, Latara, this is my situation. I was charged with this. But once I took my plea and once I got hold, you know, I was out and I could access law books because, you know, in the county jail, their time is so limited to the law library. You know, they may not even get to go. Most times they don't even get to go. It can be a court order for them. A judge can sign an order saying allow them time to go to the law library, and those orders are continually disregarded. So many times, you know, they don't have access to go to the law library and read up on things. So I had a person that actually took a plea so they could go ahead and get on out. Once they did and they were able to access law books, they realized, hey, I was overcharged. And the question to me was, Latara, if I could see that I was overcharged, and I'm sure that my attorney could have saw that I was overcharged, and I don't understand why my attorney did not, you know, address that issue and try to make that, you know, part of negotiations that he had going on for me. I didn't have an answer.
I think if a defendant pleads guilty to a crime that they most definitely should have, that falls back on the, you know, the defense attorney, because they shouldn't have, you know, advised their client to go ahead and plead guilty to something that they absolutely shouldn't have.
Right.
Because a lot of criminal defendants, they don't know anything, like you said. They don't know a lot about the law. A lot of them, it's their first time, you know, being in the courtroom, having to go to trial, facing all these criminal charges. So they don't know. And so it's really important that an attorney would give proper advice. And if an attorney were to tell a defendant to plead guilty to a crime that they shouldn't, then that definitely would fall back on them. That would be ineffective on their behalf.
Right. And then the first thing I thought about when this person was telling me this is when they take the stand and they agree to take the plea, they are admitting that they've done, you know, what they've been accused of doing or whatever they're getting ready to take the time on. So if an attorney knows that their client really didn't do this, but you're telling them, hey, go ahead and take this plea, It seemed kind of backwards to me, because that's like asking your client to commit perjury, get up there and say, yeah, you did. I mean, I don't know. That's just the first thing that came to my mind.
And right. And it happens all the time, too. And not only is it, do they plead guilty to something they didn't do or that they shouldn't be pleading guilty to, it also affects their ability to appeal, because if you plead guilty, can't, you know, appeal your case on direct appeal. It limits your ability to appeal your conviction, because you've basically you know, you admitted to the fact that you committed a crime.
Right. That just made me think of something else in a whole nother case. but no, and you're exactly correct. And people don't understand this. And I hope those that are listening, you know, are really paying attention to what we are talking about, because it is such an important issue. And it's not good when prosecutors overcharge. But unfortunately, that's the way of the game. This is what they do. It's almost like they pop out of law school and then they become a assistant prosecutor, whatever, and that's the way that they go, and it's not right. Now, Taylor, what is your field of law that you work in?
So I predominantly do criminal appellate work. So post-conviction, after someone has been convicted of a crime, we'll kind of step in. We can do direct appeals. Any sort of post-conviction sort of appeal is normally what we do in our office.
You have a lot of cases, I bet you, in your office where individuals are saying, hey, they have what's considered a post-conviction claim of actual innocence, and you guys fight to help to get them out. Is that kind of the area that you work in as well?
Absolutely, yeah. We have multiple clients who have, I mean, extremely viable cases of innocence that, you know, that they kind of got screwed over, you know, not had bad attorneys, were basically given bad advice and ended up in prison, a lot of them for life, some of them even on death row. But it's pretty crazy some of the things that we come across in our practice.
Right. I'm just knocked off my feet as I was reading a lot of these issues about prosecutorial overcharging, you know, because we know that it happens. It happens on a daily basis. It's like, what can we as a community do to address this issue? What can we do? I mean, what can we do to stop this?
I think the biggest thing is that there needs to be some sort of a reform that would hold prosecutors accountable for their actions, just because right now there's no mechanism for them to get in trouble for doing this. So they have absolutely no incentive to not overcharge, because it helps them out, because like I mentioned before, the more cases they can work through the system just by having the charged individual plead guilty, it makes their life easier. So some sort of mechanism to basically monitor their behavior and make sure that this isn't happening all the time, because right now there's really no other way aside from holding prosecutors accountable for their actions.
Wow. Everyone, you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI. My name is Latara Smith. I'm with the Casey Freedom Project, and I am interviewing Taylor Rickard, attorney at law, and we are speaking on the subject of prosecutorial overcharging this morning and how it affects our community and what is it that we can do about it to address this issue. And, you know, Taylor, it is... Do you see a lot of cases where there's been prosecutorial overcharging?
Yeah, and I think one of the sort of outcomes that happens a lot with prosecutorial overcharging is that one of the things that occurs is that because prosecutors have the ability to, they have a broad discretion in order to, you know, file a charge, and they also have broad discretion to drop charges. Doing this kind of creates a massive disparity in sentencing outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a defendant, someone that's charged with the same crime, two criminal defendants that have been charged with the exact same crime, same facts, may end up getting widely different sentences just because this occurs. And it just depends on, you know, what the prosecutor feels like as far as offering a plea deal and all that stuff. So that's one thing that really does happen a lot.
People don't see that this is what's going on. I have something else here highlighted that I wanted to read when I was reading up on prosecutorial overreaching, also known as prosecutorial overcharging. And this absolutely was just was like, yeah, this is what happens on a daily basis. It says there are other advantages that prosecutors obtain by overcharging defendants. Generally, bail is initially established by a bail schedule, which provides for higher bail amounts for serious offenses. Because bail is set artificially high by overcharging, it is more difficult for the families of those who are incarcerated to bail out their loved one. When a defendant must remain in custody while his or her case is pending, there is an increased pressure on the defendant to plead guilty quickly, particularly if it will mean being released from custody. This can be even more unfair for those who have, what they say, immigration issues, because sometimes they plead out a case that was overcharged only to find out that they will be subject to an immigration hold and a potential deportation. Mm-hmm. Wow. And I just saw a case of that on the news here not too long ago where that actually, you know, the person took a plea deal on a criminal deal. And then, you know, of course, they deported them. But, you know, the point that I wanted to pull out of what I just read is what I kind of touched base on before, which is the simple fact that their bail is going to be higher. And if anyone is in the jail atmosphere, okay, because it is not a great one to be in, and you're there and you're just sitting there and they come to you and they say, hey, listen, you know, take this plea. And, you know, you're sitting here and you're looking at the conditions around you like, wow, I want to get out of here. I'm going to get back to my family. I need to get back to work, you know, and people take those pleas when they were overcharged in the beginning.
Well, yeah, and I think kind of, you know, a way that they do this, and I may have touched on this before, is that prosecutors, when they do overcharge, when they come out with these plea deals to a defendant, it'll make it look like, you know, the prosecutor is being really friendly and they're giving the defendant this awesome deal to have
yes.
them plead guilty, when really it's the charge that they should have been charged with in the first place.
Right, right, right. And I have seen prosecutors also come back and offer a plea deal. And, you know, the person that I was advocating for, had I not sat down with that individual and went over the sentencing guidelines, you know, for that particular crime or whatever, you know, he thought the prosecutor was just giving him this awesome deal. And I'm like, no, dude, she hit you at the maximum is 10 years. And that's what she hit you with. She didn't right. negotiate anything with you. But there again, he would have never known that if he didn't, you know, have someone to sit down and go over these types of things with him. Because, you know, everyone just doesn't think, oh, let me study. Let me study guidelines and, you know, I mean, you know, let me study, you know, sentencing guidelines and things like that. You know, what can happen to me? You know, what's the maximum in this type of crime? And if I take this plea, you know, where are they hitting me? Are they hitting me at the maximum? Are they hitting me in the middle? Are they hitting me, you know, on the lower end of the deal? And that's just simply because people don't know. And I think it's horrible that prosecutors, not all prosecutors, take advantage of people like that. I think it's horrible. I really do. I honestly do.
Like you said, it's not all of them. They're not all evil.
Right.
But there are some that do it, and, you know, the ones that do it keep getting away with it, and that's a problem.
Right, exactly. So, Taylor, why don't you give the people your contact information in case there's anyone listening that wants to speak with you or may have any questions for you. You mind giving you want to give your contact information?
Sure. If you have any other questions, you can feel free to call us up at Law Office of Kent Gibson, and our phone number is 816-363-4400.
Okay. And do you have do you guys have a website that people can refer to?
Sure. Our website is actually under construction right now, so it's going to be getting a new email or a new
okay,
name
awesome.
Here pretty soon. But
okay.
I believe it is kentgibsonlaw.com.
Okay. And I just had a question came in, and I want to ask you this. And they wanted to know, can a public defender be held accountable? Let me see the question that came in again. Can the public defender get in trouble for not advising their client properly?
So after somebody is convicted or someone pleads guilty, there is a procedural mechanism. If the client were to plead guilty, it would be Rule 24035 in Missouri, and if they were to have a jury trial or a trial, it would be under Rule 2915. And under those sort of, this happens right after if a case would either be on direct appeal or if a client pled guilty right after they were sentenced. But you can raise claims of ineffectiveness of counsel. So that sort of issue could be raised in a post-conviction proceeding.
Taylor Reed, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know it was kind of last minute that we set this up, but I thank you so much for coming on the show. And I know this information that you have provided us this morning is going to bless someone, and prayerfully, it's not just going to bless them, but it's also going to open their eyes to maybe a judicial system that they may be dealing with and, you know, needed some insight on. So once again, Taylor, thank you so much for calling in this morning. Okay, you guys have a blessed day over there at the law firm.
You too.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and here's a segment from last week's Cultural Baggage program.
All right, next up we hear from Dr. Donald Tashkin, the UCLA lung specialist and government scientist funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Here's his take regarding tobacco as opposed to medical cannabis.
You are at risk of developing COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is manifested by an accelerated rate of loss of lung function over time as you grow older. We failed to find a similar relationship with marijuana. So that was one finding. We are also interested in the investigating the possibility that marijuana smoking might lead to lung cancer. Now, lung cancer is largely mainly attributable to tobacco smoking. And since marijuana and tobacco share similar ingredients, including a number of carcinogens, it's a reasonable hypothesis that smoking marijuana, at least heavily over a long period of time, could predispose to the development of lung cancer. Maybe not to the same extent as tobacco, but to a greater extent than if you didn't smoke any marijuana or tobacco at all. So we did a very large study, which we call a case control study. And in that study, we identified 600 patients who were diagnosed with lung cancer, an additional 600 patients or so who were diagnosed with head and neck cancer, like throat cancer, lip cancer, tongue cancer, and over 1,000 control subjects who did not have cancer. And then we administered a detailed questionnaire to all these subjects, including questions about marijuana use and tobacco use and family history of cancer and other putative risk factors that could predispose to cancer. And the results were entirely negative. If anything, the risk for developing lung cancer was slightly less in relation to marijuana than no marijuana, although not statistically significantly so. Despite the fact that the study was designed as well as we could possibly design it, and it included a large number of subjects, over 100 of whom smoked marijuana heavily, both in the among the cases and the controls, I think we can say with some confidence that there just is no evidence that of an association between marijuana use and lung cancer.
Again, that was Dr. Donald Tashkin of NIDA, and I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.